Welcome back to our second session of this morning. I'm Alistair Edgar from the Laurier Center for Military Strategic and Disarmament Studies. I'm going to chair the panel today on law and counterterrorism. And our main speaker today is Ruth Wedgwood. As everybody has said this morning as well, biomaterials are in your conference packets, so I won't do extensive introductions. I'll simply tell you, Ruth is the Edward Burling Professor of International Law and Diplomacy and Director of the International Law Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, has recently returned from India, and seems to be in good shape, so I'm pleased to see that she's here for us today. And I will give my space on the podium over to Ruth, and she'll be talking for 25 to 30 minutes, and then I'll start to cry as I see the clock going any further than that. Thank you very much.
Well, it's very nice to be back in Canada. I'm a huge admirer of Michael Ignatieff and of Robert Fowler. Well, not every position he takes on every issue, but... I like his prose, and of Bob Fowler, and of so many people who were really sort of signal in the high romantic period of the 90s in the revival of the United Nations was really Canada's place in the sun in Manhattan, and between the International Peace Academy and the Canadian Mission, many good ideas got stood up, including conflict diamonds. Which was a very important issue. I have actually largely checked out of the terrorism debate since Torturegate, since I found that distressing episode. So I'm seeing it a little bit more from afar. We do get some secondary, tertiary issues having to do with terrorism in the Human Rights Committee in Geneva, which I'll talk about. But I do have to say that probably my basic... And we'll have lots of robust conversation on this, I'm sure. But my basic worldview on the difficulties of approaching effective counterterrorism is, as in my wayward youth as a prosecutor, where I spent 2 years doing policy in Washington with the Carter administration, which is ancient history now, and including a funny kid who had thrown the KH-11 satellite manual over the fence of the Soviet embassy in Athens, and we had to figure out how to try him without divulging all of the operational details of the manual to the Russians already knew it, obviously, but to everybody else. So we invented some trial procedures for in limine protective orders and substitutions of generic information for details, and tried the case. It was the Campilly's case, and that later became included in the Classified Information Procedures Act of the, I guess that was the Carter administration too. God, we date ourselves. But the difficulties in trying cases that involve sensitive information were very much in my youth, and then when I went to Southern District of New York to try to become rough and tough, I wasn't going to be a backroom female library lawyer. I wanted to be a rangy little... Davy Crockett or something, I had a Bulgarian spy case where we had the same problems, and very handsome gentleman, Penyu Bechev Kostadinov, who was hitting on a Columbia graduate student and asking him to get various funny documents, including ultimately a nuclear securities safeguards document. I wish it, in some ways he'd gotten it because it was just before Chernobyl blew up, so maybe the Soviets should have had better access to what we knew about nuclear security. But in the course of trying that case, we anticipated that we'd have great difficulty in even admitting the res delicti, highly classified Department of Energy document that was the meat on the table at the meeting at the top of the Gulf and Western building in Columbus Circle in Manhattan, where we finally arrested him. How do you try a case which centers on national security without having the trial itself cause more damage than the underlying event? We eventually traded him to the Soviet bloc, but so it didn't go to trial, but it was really very much on our minds. The reason why I find this in some ways an anguishing topic is I think we all think we're liberals in a certain Western traditional sense, whether we're conservative or liberal on a particular issue. But what does it mean to be liberal on terrorism? I do take the Canadian idea of R2P. Well, I'm sorry, it's Australian too, isn't it? Oh, Gareth Evans. But R2P, which is a cute coinage, but it profoundly important idea of responsibility to protect, that the state's interest in preserving public safety and order is not necessarily tendentious. It means the welfare of human beings, who are the citizens, who have as much right to be protected against private violence as public violence. And I used to see prosecuting as a public service job. It was a human rights job to me, because you were protecting people against what other people do to them. So in light of R2P, I don't think that framing the issue of terrorism and counterterrorism as human rights necessarily answers the questions, because victims have rights, too. Victims have a right to be protected. So stipulating, even if you stipulate the moral, make it ontological priority of human rights, it doesn't answer some of the hard questions. Let me just first talk about some of the interesting issues that have come up in economic sanctions, thinking of sanctions as a way to cut off financing for terrorist groups or terrorist regimes. This has, as you know, proven much harder than we expected it to be. If you just took September 11th by itself, the amount of money that cost was minuscule, $500,000. The idea of trying to find that in the financial flows of the macroeconomy, even with perfect access to the SWIFT interbank transfer system, is very difficult. And the reason I asked a question last night of our New York Times correspondent was that, indeed, one of the few tools for looking at financial flows was the SWIFT system. And whenever those issues become public, you then lose a vantage point. But they don't cost much. The few journalists that have tried to do some descriptive work on this have run into English libel law, which is quite notorious, and apparently now so tendentious that it's interfering with free scientific debate about the efficacy of cures. But there was a very interesting, unhelpful, shall we say, responsive campaign that when some description of financial flows misusing the charitable intentions of Muslim almsgiving were published, that in turn these led to lawsuits in England. And English law, I hope Canadian law is different, actually requires the defendant, the publisher, the writer, the author, to prove by common law rules of admissibility of the truth of what he asserts, which makes it very difficult to be a historian, much less to be a journalist, and has therefore become a huge incentive to stay away from contentious areas. So part of the difficulty also just in getting a handle on what occurs in financial flows is that often the best work is not done by the CIA, believe me, but by private people who have passions. And it's become much more dangerous to publish and share that work because of English libel law, which we have been gently encouraging them to reform, to have some kind of public figure exception, to perhaps put the burden of proof on the plaintiff, to control attorney's fees, but to make it possible to have a free and vivacious press without having to worry about being in hock for £1 million or £2 million. So that really is a problem because, indeed, the kind of pertinaciousness of journalists is something that my little tour inside the government has shown me that we know very little. And you're much better off being a smart PhD student, reading the press, and becoming a regional specialist if you really want to know things. So to shut down, shall we say, open source reporting is a serious matter. So that's something I think that Canada might want to look at, too. I don't know what your libel law is like. Then there's the actual issue of the economic sanctions themselves. As you know, there are a series of Security Council resolutions that have tried to control individuals that it thinks are engaged in nefarious activity by having a list of targetable entities and individuals under 1267 and 1340. And the council, as you know, has often in modern practice made itself almost into an administrative agency of not just having the precatory, hortatory resolution, but then trying to implement it. And what it's discovered is that the same dilemmas of fairness that a government has in taking any action against an individual are don't go away if you're multilateral. There's no exemption from the same anguishing dilemmas if you're a multilateral organization. So lately, in the Security Council venue in which certain organizations and certain individuals were listed, states parties were required to nominate, if you will, people who they thought were attached to Al-Qaeda, there has been a great difficult conversation about how you assure fairness to that individual and yet can clamp down on terrorist financing. And it's the same dilemmas you guys are having with security certificates. It's the same dilemma that one has with control orders in England. If you have information that depends upon confidential sources that would not cooperate if they knew that their names were going to be revealed, what do you do? And so far, there's no answer. I think the Security Council has become a little bit more aware of this and has appointed focal points for individuals who feel they have been prejudiced to come and present their exculpatory information. But there has been this pushback by human rights bodies and other judicial bodies, which is now making it very contentious. In the European Court of Justice, we North Americans, since we're naughty people, tend to think of the Europeans as being very UN-minded, international law-minded. But in this very interesting Qadi case, the European Court of Justice instead said, we are an autonomous legal and moral community. We find that the listing procedures, the requirement that states give over names, cannot be excused by Article 103, the supremacy of the UN Charter, that European human rights norms still have to apply, and therefore that a state could be liable for, as it were, there's no immunity from human rights norms by virtue of having received a superior order from the UN. So the Qadi case, rather like the Braillard case, or the U.S. position in the death penalty cases, says that European norms, in fact, trump UN security measures, and that somehow the two regimes will have to find a way to live with each other. And so, too, in my committee in Geneva, although I took a principled dissent, said that we had the right to directly review a country that was complying with the Security Council's demands. Now, people have always supposed that the Security Council should not act heedlessly of law. But at the same time, there are moments when the Council does things that are beyond the developed borderline of international law, whether it's in the demand that Libya give over the two Lockerbie bombers suspects, or where there was no customary law of extradition that would have demanded their production. So I think from the Security Council's point of view, this kind of flexibility of being able to do a little bit of invention. McIlwain had a lovely distinction between jurisdictio, which was the law, and gubernaculum, which was the emergency measures of the prince. And the council's always had that kind of princely power, but maybe not anymore. It's an open and contentious debate. So that's one problem. How the heck do you get at financial flows? Second is the one, again, that stems from my youth. Is criminal law by itself adequate to deal with problems of terrorism? And I have to say, one of the great pleasures of being on this committee in Geneva is being around really good civil lawyers and learning the kind of granularity about civil law systems, which you would never get from a case book on ideal types. So I've learned a little bit about how illiberal, truly illiberal, European law is, despite the European Court of Human Rights. And it puts one to conclude that some of the anguish that the common law system feels now in trying to respond effectively, it may be a virtue, it may be a vice, but it's different from Europe. Europe, with its civil law system, has measures that will strike a North American as tendentious, but probably have also allowed the Europeans to be less open in their adaptation of their system. The first issue that really struck me was this pre-charge detention that many European systems permit. In America, I'm sure in Canada, if you arrest somebody, you better be prepared to go to trial very quickly, have a grand jury indictment or a charge, and put them on trial within 30 or 60 days with open discovery of all the evidence. In France, until recently, and even now, le juge d'instruction. There's a whole TV series about a female juge d'instruction, real rough, tough cookie, can hold you on a predicate whose real meaning I can't even begin to fathom. Suspicion sur les éléments graves et profonds. Grave and suspicious elements. What the hell does that mean? I once asked Balthazar Garzon, how does he hold people pre-charge, pre-trial? He said, indication, imputation. What the hell does that mean? Indications and imputations. This is not a probabilistic mode of thought. And I suppose if you live the life, you might have a sense of what that really is. But from a distance, it seems like sheer suspicion. It sounds much more like Article 5 of Geneva 4, which says that a power during wartime occupation can hold somebody upon definite suspicion. I wonder if a European drafted that. But what happens in, at least to my knowledge, Spain, France, and Holland, is that you have this kind of pre-charge detention where you may not go to trial, much less get charged, for years. In France, you could be held for up to 10 years until recently. Now it's 4 years. In Holland, you can be held for 2 or 3 years. Secondly, I think to North Americans, the right to counsel, the autonomy of self, the right against self-incrimination, just seem fundamental. In France and Holland, I've learned, you can see your lawyer after some period in detention, 72 hours or longer, but the lawyer just sees you for about 30 minutes, then goes away, and the lawyer cannot direct the police to stop questioning you, and the police don't have to stop questioning you, and the lawyer in Holland can't even be present while the police are questioning you. So my experience as a prosecutor where Bob Morvillo from a boutique firm would say, don't answer that question. Doesn't happen in Holland. These are inquisitorial, in the nastiest sense, if you will, of societies. This is not simply lapidary question and answer. Do you feel like talking to me? This is pretty tough questioning. So you have systems in Europe where the issue of looking for alternative sources of law probably never arises because their criminal law is, you can pick your own adjective, but not as liberal, not as cutting the question in the favor of innocence as the common law system. Third issue is admissibility of evidence. We all knew this from school, I guess, but the Europeans allow hearsay evidence in. They give it less weight. Mittelbarkeit versus unmittelbarkeit, intermediated versus direct evidence. But it all comes in, just like it does in the war crimes tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia and ICC. And therefore, this true difficulty of finding some fool who's willing to risk his life to come to court to raise his hand to testify in the face of the defendant, which is very hard to get in real life in any case, doesn't necessarily arise in European trials or in international trials. And therefore, the common law system, again, I think has posed its own peculiar difficulties in trying to make criminal law suit the case. Privilege against self-incrimination, I'm sure that's in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, yes? Which I have always taken to mean, A, you don't have to answer questions, B, they can't say nothing about it. Well, in England, I discovered from my dear friend Jeffrey Nice, that's no longer true. If you fail to answer the police questions when they first come upon you, that can be argued as proof of guilt. If you fail to take the stand at trial, that can be argued as proof of guilt. Not sufficient proof, but relevant proof. So the right against self-incrimination is also very different in the European system, which, again, I think affects the... I'm not recommending the European system, mind you. I'm just explicating, I think, why we common lawyers have felt peculiarly... peculiar difficulties. And finally, if I can just mention a few more items, one is the viva voce trial versus the dossier system. If you're an American prosecutor or I suspect Canadian prosecutor, you got to get your witnesses to court on trial day, have them tough it out, you know, be brave. Subpoenas are just a piece of paper, but you got to make them want to come and take the stand and face somebody. Whereas in Europe, you can have a dossier where the witness has been confronted with the juge d'instruction, which is much less threatening than having to face the defendant one-on-one and easier to muster. Also, I think in real life, if you look at how the common law system responds to most kinds of transactions, there's been professionalization of law enforcement. You insert an undercover agent, you get a NAGRA tape recorder, you have a wiretap. You don't depend upon the frailty of human nature to try to get historical witnesses who've seen an event that didn't happen at the instigation of the state. Rather, you try to set up something that is really, in fact, a crime, but a crime with somebody who's paid to be there to take the risks and to record it. That's very hard to do in most terrorism cases with clans, ethnic groups to which one's agents may not belong, although I think the FBI learned a long time ago that it's very good, not just on moral reasons, but practical reasons to have evidence of agents of every hue and color, just to get information and to be plausible in undercover operations. But I do think some of the sense of dilemma in the last, make it 15 years, not just the Bush folks, has been that the common law system is really a very hard criminal system to operate in any other than a number of kind of traditional settings for prosecution. And therefore, criminal law has, I think, been seen as difficult and created the motive to look toward other bodies of law. I think that's why you began to get interest in material witness warrants. Can you hold somebody pre-charge, pre-indictment, and still have the ability to ask them questions? Looking at immigration law as a surrogate, looking at law of armed conflict as a surrogate. Because the common law, which we have largely constitutionalized, I don't know if you've done it to the same extent as we have, but most of the presuppositions of the common law system are either in our Bill of Rights in plain text or we've read them into the Bill of Rights and therefore very difficult to change. No one would want to change them, but then we're in kind of a more of a Manichaean either-or choice set. Now, a law of armed conflict, if I had one critique of the field, it's and it's why it's hard to teach. It's why many of us like that ICRC, customary law restatement, even if we might quarrel with particular claims that it makes. The most fundamental principles of IHL are scattered in the most oddly numbered provisions of the Geneva Conventions, Hague Conventions, for students when you're just trying to get them to have a few big ideas. You can't take them to Article 41A3. It just doesn't work. There's no architectonic simplicity to it that makes it easy to teach, much less easy to apply. And Marco and I were just at San Remo, a very interesting German scholar there, trying to liken the current fight with Al-Qaeda. Which of the various settled Geneva and Hague Convention rules are most like the war in Afghanistan? None of them quite work. So you do, I think, have a kind of call it a fallacy of concreteness, the desire to find a single paradigm that fits each war. International war, internal war with an international aspect. If you're doing criminal law, where the law has to be settled and clear, I can see why judges would do that. But it does confuse the field for lay people. And I think this is apropos to Marco's work with armed groups as well. If you don't keep it simple, you can't teach it. If you don't keep it simple, it doesn't announce itself as jus cogens, as fundamental, self-evident moral principle. If it sounds too technical, it's actually an impediment to its acceptance. But I do think that's been one problem. IHL lawyers can become exceedingly technical if you're not careful. Even in the Hamdan case in the Supreme Court, which settled finally that Article 3 of 3rd Geneva of 1949 would be applied, which it doesn't say much other than don't do disgraceful things to people. When Neil Katyal, who was arguing for Hamdan, the driver of bin Laden, argued the case, I probably would have urged him to take this phrase out of his oral argument if I'd been tutoring him. He characterized it as a stateless, territory-less war for which there's no applicable Geneva Convention, one would suppose. And common Article 3, I think, was accepted by the Supreme Court because they don't feel comfortable with the Martens Clause. They ain't never heard of it. They don't feel comfortable with customary law. So Article 3 was the best textual instantiation of the basic norms and moral minima of IHL. Then you add the claims of human rights law. And again, as Marco was saying, the European Court of Human Rights has been wondering what to do with this. My committee has been wondering what to do with it. We say that human rights law applies everywhere for covenant states, including offshore. If someone's in the effective control of the state party, what does that mean? If you're bombing somebody, is that effective control? Probably not. And yet in the Gaza report, Goldstone takes choice of targets in bombardment as itself being ruled by human rights law as such. Bankovic, the Yugoslav bombing case, says no. But other than conceding that where IHL exists, it may be a lex specialis, a particularly apropos interpretation of human rights law, apart from that, the field is very unclear. And what would be a targeted killing with a predator to a NATO commander could be seen as an extrajudicial execution by a straight human rights lawyer. How is it that you have such a different predicate for choosing a bombing target than you do for conviction? I think that some of the disparities here are troublesome to folks. Now, on the famous topic of closing Guantanamo and the appropriate role of the Congress and the courts, the kind of slow burn of President Obama's administration has been interesting to watch. One of the early solutions they proposed was to use penitentiaries. And that sounds fine and dandy till you read Third Geneva Article 22, which says no penitentiaries, ever. One person said to me, one of my last conversations, said, what if we don't call it a penitentiary? I said, works for you, but doesn't probably persuade a court. Now, if it's only common Article 3, does that prohibition apply? Maybe not, but if you're thinking about what common Article 3 is meant to do, which is to establish moral minima, why would you be treating a irregular combatant so different from a regular combatant? Penitentiaries have a punitive quality. They're meant to be unpleasant if you're an old Quaker who wants to encourage moral reflection, penitence. They're certainly not what one would suppose that the 1949 drafters intended. So there's no agreement where you can put people. There's still no agreement on predicates. And if you think of IHL, and I'll stop very quickly, Mr. Chairman, but if you think of IHL as adapting itself to the vagaries of wartime chaos and therefore not demanding the same kind of truly finely honed fact-finding that you expect at a criminal trial. Rough and ready classifications, easier in World War II when people wore uniforms. But nobody theretofore, and nobody since 9/11, has settled upon the standard of sufficiency of proof for showing that somebody is an irregular combatant. If you were doing charity work in Afghanistan and you come from far away and you had no very credible story, but they have no proof that you picked up a weapon or... What if you did go to the Al-Farouk training camp, but you got kicked out? That's a recent case. What if they think you went to the Al-Farouk training camp, but all the evidence is hearsay? That's a recent case. What's happened is that procedure has been used as a substitute for substance. And what you have are the habeas corpus cases going to federal district judges who could use it's very interesting for them. They get tired of narcotics cases. I suspect they're having an interesting time, but are reaching heterodox decisions with no particular integration of the views on what evidence probability has to be met, what counts as a sufficient weight of evidence, because we think not just probabilistically, but how big does the pool have to be, what acts count as sufficiently bellicose to make one a combatant. All of this is being now invented creatively by individual district judges who have probably not taken very much IHL, nor their law clerks. And even if they had, there's nothing that tells you this issue, how to answer this. So there has been, in a funny way, a you could call it abdication. The Congress doesn't want to do this. The courts are put to do it because the habeas corpus cases bring it before them. But I think if Greg Craig survives in the White House, who's a smart guy, actually, I hope he does. But there has been, so far, not a great appetite for trying to take on these issues in a systematic and principled way that you could defend. It's being left to the creativity of the common law system. And finally, I'll just note that on the issue, which people did worry about, my friend David Cole, to whom I often felt married, we did so many panels together in the early days, how do you know how long you can detain somebody in an endless war? So far, President Obama's administration is still relying on the original AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force Against Al-Qaeda, as the basis for detention. They haven't tried to justify it as Article 5, Geneva 4. They're just going on Congress's authorization with no clear view on how one would then judge the end of that war. And finally, I'll just note as something I think the human rights community can help cure. On the issue of returning people, non-refoulement has been a terrible challenge. This is a view that you can't return somebody to a regime where you have highly significant reason to believe they're going to be physically mistreated or misused. From the 51 Refugee Convention, now read into the guarantees against torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment in the human rights conventions. But can you ever accept diplomatic assurances? Some people say no, some people say yes. Felice Geyer, who you may not know, at the Jacob Blaustein Institute in New York, she's on the torture committee too, she's vice chairman of CAT, has an interesting proposal of really robust diplomatic assurances with rights of inspection of the corpus delicti, if I may, to make sure the person actually is, like an ICRC visit, in private, without surveillance, to make sure the person really isn't being mistreated. But the absolutist account of non-refoulement, that you can never return somebody to a nasty country, because most of the countries they come from are nasty, has created this dilemma of what to do. It's actually affecting piracy as well. No one wants to capture pirates in the Gulf of Aden, because what the hell would you do with them? Once you're stuck with them, the Germans, what did they put? They called it Guantanamo on the Gulf or something. Droll, not so funny like that. But it really is an issue that needs to be practicably addressed in some fashion. Lots of other issues, surveillance and privacy. In my own moral lexical ordering, I'd much rather have surveillance than physical mistreatment of anybody. Even if I value my privacy, that's the first thing I would give up rather than integrity of the moral of the body. That's an issue. There's also one other issue out there, which is quite interesting, which is a Canadian case. I think we finished it. I'm not sure if it's on the web yet. The issue of deportation and common law citizenship. We just had an interesting case in which non-terrorist circumstances, just a Haitian Canadian kid who had been involved in some serious crimes. And the question was, if you hadn't ever been formally naturalized, should you be held in human rights terms, right to family, right to private life, to have nonetheless acquired a kind of common law citizenship that would prevent your deportation, just as you can't exile a citizen for a crime. You punish him, you rehabilitate him, and you release him. So if you've been in Canada for 22 years but have committed 4 or 5 serious crimes of violence, could you be deported to your country of origin where you have not lived for so many years? And the committee said, no, you can't. Building on some European Court of Human Rights law. So that, I think, is something that, again, countries are going to find a challenge to live with practicably and humanely. I think that the immediate trauma of 9/11 is past. One hopes that in a Sassolian fashion that the issue of even for a group that seeks to make a splash through public violence, that a kind of common horror at certain kinds of attacks on civilians would be seen as so delegitimating that it will lead to their second thought. And in a way, I think that happened somewhat to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Some of the attacks were seen as so terrible, including the mosque in Samarra, that it in fact delegitimated their popularity among youth in some countries. One hopes that will happen, and so for the moment I think it seems less urgent than it did back 8 years ago. But frankly, very few of the legal questions have been seriously joined or settled, and the kind of moral chaos and moral anomie and God hanging by a thread, your soul, that were felt in September 11th are still potentially there. And in the, if you will, the remission from emergency, I think people have just chosen to let it all lie till the next time, which is probably not a very good way to proceed. So, thank you very much.